Hi, this is James White once again for the Solution Series, brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. And we have a great show today, very timely. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Corey Lynn. Corey, always great to be with you.
Great to be here. Looking
it
forward
is indeed.
To this one.
Yes, we have so many great guests here on the Solution Series, and we've had such great feedback. And we do appreciate the folks that do tune in and to participate in this. We do so much, thank you for your participation and your support. And today is, I'll tell you, today's going to be a good one, like they all are. We're talking about the surveillance society that you sort of see that we're in. It's here now. We've talked about it for many years, and it seems like we're in it now. There seem to be managing the traffic lights and, of course, all your smartphones and the facial recognition. All that stuff we're going to cover today with our guest, Rob Braxman. And let me give Rob a proper introduction. Rob is the internet privacy guy on YouTube. He's been talking about privacy issues on social media for the last 10 years. He is currently most active on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. He's a public interest hacker and technologist. He uses his extensive knowledge of cybersecurity and technology to serve the public good. He cares about privacy, and he can warn you of digital manipulation, disinformation, and mass surveillance. He's a successful software architect and has had a career building enterprise system and founding those companies. He's the creator of Brax.me social media app for privacy enthusiasts and creates products and services for the purpose of defending our privacy. Rob Braxman, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Solution Series.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. So if we can, let's just, I mean, just a good place to start would be sort of, we'd like to do like the 30,000 foot view and then kind of, go down into, drill down into things. We know a lot about the problems. We're here to talk about solutions, but let's just do a reset here. When did this begin? I mean, the computers came around like in the 80s, smartphones came around. When did really, Rob, this whole surveillance thing really kind of get ramped up? Was it after 9/11? Was that the sort of the catalyzing event that in the Patriot Act that sort of opened all that up? Or was that sort of in the works before then, and that just kind of helped maybe, or maybe it had nothing to do with it? I'll go ahead and turn it over to you, Rob. Thanks.
When the internet first started, I already knew back then that the internet was open, that you can see everything that goes on in it. And I was already worried about this, that it's going to be used. And of course, that has been proven to be true. So you can say that at least the internet side of things started in the 90s when the internet started. And it's just the whole structure of the internet. It allows for this. Now, the government was already doing surveillance via the telephone system, the public switch telephone network, PSTN. So they were already doing that forever, right? But the internet side of things didn't start until the 90s. And one of the things that was to me, the early indicator of what might happen was email, because email is wide open. It's a standard that is based on plain text. So anyone could have read email. So I said immediately that this is going to be surveilled. And of course, Snowden revealed that that was in fact happening, and that AT&T was the primary infrastructure for doing that even back then. But it didn't really turn into this personal surveillance thing, because not everyone was on the internet in the 90s. It didn't turn into this personal surveillance issue until the phones came out. So actually it started in 2007. That's when they started to realize, let's do this. And of course, Google itself was founded by funding from three-letter agencies. So they already knew that that was going to happen. So the combination of the Google side for the internet, and then they said, oh, we can go really personal here. And so they went to the phone. And then in the last few years, that has gone to the extreme.
Yeah, and the phones, I think, is a great place to start, because I get a lot of emails every day. And I got to tell you, the number one question I get is, what phones can we switch to? And a lot of people will ask me about what to do about VPNs or search engines or various things with their computers. And we'll get into some of that. But I know a whole lot when it comes to the smartphones. So I'm wondering, as far as, I know you talk about de-Googling them, and you talk about having different phone numbers, even multiple phones or multiple SIM cards. So I'm going to let you kind of take that away on where you want to go with that and explain what can be done. And as far as protecting oneself through these wonderful smartphones, even though I'd like to tell everyone to just ditch their smartphones, I don't know how realistic that is. So if you want to start there, that would be great.
So the first issue, and this requires some careful thought here. And many, many people talk about being experts and offering solutions without really grasping the entire problem. So I'm going to tell you the real problem here, because you can't just say, oh, it's a phone. It's not just the phone, and it's not just any phone. The issue has to do with something called cross-device tracking, or to be specific, how you're identified by your phone. So this is the way the internet works now. This has changed. This was not the way it was, but this has now changed. So when you go, if you have a Google account, which probably 99% of the people do, and your Google account is on your iPhone and your Android, so the phone is clearly identified as being you. Now, the identification can go further, because it could have your credit cards from using the app stores and so on. But let's just leave it at the identification side. The phone has a fixed identifier, and it's called the IMEI. That's a hardware identifier on the phone. Now, what Google realized is that, hey, we can take this surveillance thing further. Instead of it just saying, we're going to log into Google on your browser or on your computer, we want to know exactly who you are. And yeah, we try those techniques like tracking your IP address and all that, but we want to be even more specific. So in the last couple of years, what they implemented is where the Google ID is matched to all devices. All devices are now cross-tracked. It's called cross-device tracking, like I said. And it verifies you by 2FA, two-factor authentication. So the moment you go to Google, they say, we require you to do two-factor authentication. And that's been required heavily now, 2 years for me now, and for some people, only a year. And with a few exceptions, they've pretty much covered everyone with 2FA, two-factor authentication, meaning use your phone as your identifier. So you're on your computer and you're on your phone, and the phone now matches, and they say, we know who you are because we can see you're logged into the phone right now. And this is true of all phones, what I call normie phones. It's a phone that has your standard operating system like iOS or Android, Google Android. And what happens is there's telemetry, and it's sending out a ping to Google saying, oh yeah, this phone with this IMEI, which is the identifier, is logged in with this Google ID. So they always know where you are. You can go into your browser, hide your location, do whatever trick you want, but they know where the phone is. So this is the thing that I am trying to explain to people, is that the main problem with the phone is identity. If you have a device that doesn't identify you, then they can track all they want. The data is useless. But when they know you by name, they know exactly who you are. They know everything you do. They know every click on the internet. And if you don't know how Google Analytics works, everything that you do on the internet is matched to that Google ID, as long as you've logged in at some point. You don't even have to be logged in now. If you've logged into at some point, it tracks everything you do on the internet. Now that is now confirmed with that phone using that Google ID as the identifier. So that's the main problem I'm trying to solve.
Rob, can I ask you a question? So I know there are people out there that have nefarious intentions with this type of technology. How much of that do you think is people that are trying to do, you know, maybe in your best interest, and people that just want to make money? They just want to track you for ads so they know where you're going, so they can put ads in front of your computer. Like you're talking, I've been before having a conversation, next thing you know, something pops up on your phone or your computer based upon what you've been talking about. Do you think that these people that are trying to do all this tracking, do you think that money is a great motivation for them? Or is it all about control? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. I what you're talking about is what I referred to as third-party trackers. So they're really the companies, you know, doing the advertising and so on. They're not the threat. They don't know exactly who you are. They just know what Google tells them. Google's trying to block them. They have something called Flock. They changed that to something called Topics. And basically, it's a restriction. So the third parties can't really know who you are, but Google does. Now, the reason this is a much bigger problem is because Google now uses this secret information that they have. Apple has too, but Google knows everyone, including Apple devices. Because they know everything about you, then they go and manipulate the internet to follow some secret agenda. And I've revealed this in a video showing how they used it to modify your search. So you're searching for something and they're trying to manipulate you by saying, oh, we know you're right wing. So we're going to go, you know, drop some things in your search so that you see other things. And that's really, to me, the bigger threat than, you know, anything that's money oriented, because it's not really just about that. I wish it were, because then I wouldn't be in such a panic. Right. But when somebody's trying to control me, then I worry.
So how do we go about de-Googling a phone, or what is the best phone to get?
Okay, so now we can go to the specifics, because I set up the
right
the problem. The problem is you need a phone without an identity. That's really the key, a phone without an identity. How do you do that? Well, unfortunately, you cannot do that ever on a standard Google or Android phone or a normie phone, because they're built-in trackers that track location constantly that you cannot stop. There's actually no permission to stop Google or Apple from knowing the location of the phone. You can stop a third party from seeing the location. You can never, never, never stop Google and Apple from stopping location.
Even in a Faraday bag? Even in a Faraday bag, you can't stop the signal?
Yes, you can, but obviously you're using the phone, so at that moment, that
right.
you take it out.
Then, right, right on.
Then kind of you lose the point. So the solution with the Google phone is it replaces the code. The stuff that I'm telling you is tracking you, these tracking system apps, the telemetry, there's Firebase, there's so many of them. All of these telemetry apps cannot be removed. There's no way to stop them. They're hidden. They're in the system. You can't remove them. So the only way to remove them is to install a different operating system before they put that code in. And fortunately, we have that. It's called Android Open Source Project. That's what we use as a base. And then we modify that. So Android Open Source Project does not have Google proprietary code, because obviously they're not going to reveal that in open source. Fortunately for us, we can go look at this open source project and take that and then modify it and use that as the base in what we call a de-Google phone. Now, because there's no Google in it, there's no Google login, it never logs into Google, there's no telemetry, it doesn't have a Play Store, it doesn't have any of that. And then there's no identity, since you never log in. So Google can't identify the phone. And this is the thing that's interesting about Androids, the new Androids. Android open source project cannot read that IMEI, that thing that identifies that phone to be yours. So that's the key. So the Google phones in general are based on AOSP. So that's the main gist of it.
So I'm just thinking. I've seen, now you have a phone, right?
Right.
That you sell, correct?
Right.
Okay. And then I've seen other ones on the market, but you know, people like me, I mean, I'm really good with tech, but I'm not a techie. Like, I don't know the back end stuff the way you do. So I've seen others on the market too, and they'll say they're de-Googled, but I mean, how do you know? And then, so I want you to just kind of briefly talk about that, like with your phone, or, I mean, you don't have to compare to other phones if you don't want, but the other important thing is, once they have a phone like this, is not to go and log into Google, not to go start downloading social media.
I wouldn't worry about that if you have the right phone. You can't actually screw it up. Yeah, you cannot screw it up.
Oh, okay. That's good.
This is the interesting part. You cannot screw it up, and I'll explain that later. But okay, so the Googling, as I told you, is just based on Android Open Source Project, and there are many people that do it. And the most popular one, and the one I use for phones that are not mine. So let's say I'm using a Google Pixel. Let me see if I have a Google Pixel here next to me here. A Google Pixel phone. And so this phone is made by Google. And fortunately, because it's made by Google, it's completely compatible with Android Open Source Project. So the most popular operating system for de-Googling is called Lineage OS. And that's actually what I use when people ask me in my company to de-Google their phones. We use Lineage OS. So that's the most popular. And the reason it's the most popular is because it was first. And secondly, it is also the use with more phone models. So if you want to check if your phone model works, you can do it on lineageos.org and see if your phone is supported. If it is, you can de-Google it based on whatever restrictions they have on there. Now, so that's one of the ways. Now, I made my own phone. So this is my phone. It's running Brax OS.
You made your own phone? Is that what you're
saying? Yeah. So
made your own phone. That's brilliant. It's pretty brilliant.
We've been selling this phone, and we also sell the Pixels running Lineage OS. But we made our own phones, and it's actually less expensive than the Google Pixels because we don't have the overhead of Google. But and we have our own OS, and because we can control the OS better than we have with Lineage OS, because it's not ours, Lineage is somebody else doing it, some volunteers, we control this. We have a dev team that works on the OS for this. And so we have better control off the phone, because some of the problems you will find if you just say, I'm just going to go with any, OS, is updating it. That's problem number one. Second is if the phone has all the features. Typically, when you use Lineage OS, we have to tweak it here at our store to before you can even use it, because it doesn't come with anything. There's no app. There's no app store. So if you do a reset, you're kind of stuck. This one doesn't have that problem because we already pre-configured it with certain apps already pre-installed. So it's a lot easier to use. So yeah, those sort of two options. Now, there are other OSs that are based on Android open source that are equally acceptable for de-Googling. There's too many of them to even mention, but they're okay. There's no problem with that, but you have to do it yourself, obviously. And if you can do that, that's fine. My push is you don't have to buy my phones or my servers. You can do it yourself. It's more important that we all de-Google.
Now, Rob, does your camera work on your phones and the Bluetooth work and the Wi-Fi?
Everything is normal except for one thing that we actually do. We actually block the Wi-Fi triangulation that spots your indoor location. That's disabled intentionally on this.
Nice.
So it can't actually spot your location unless you give it permission. Whereas on any other phone that's not Brax OS, it is possible to get your location. Even if you didn't give it permission, because Google and Apple can do Wi-Fi triangulation and Wi-Fi scanning, all these little tricks that they do.
And so if someone wanted to then take and download social media apps or something to that effect, you're saying that is safe?
Let's cover that, because that's very important.
Yeah, because their privacy and terms and all that good stuff.
Right. This is very important. And this is a practical thing. Believe it or not, when you use a de-Google phone, especially something like Brax OS, that's already pre-configured with apps to work with an app store. We don't use Google Play Store, but we use some other store called F-Droid and Aurora Store. So there's a substitute store. When you do this on a phone, if the app can be downloaded, you can try it and see if it works. Okay. And I'll be honest with you, you can even download Facebook and it will work. It will actually give a message saying it won't work, but it actually works. I'll be honest with you too, Instagram works. Those two are the most dangerous social media apps ever. Anything to do with Facebook is the most dangerous social media apps. And you can even run, believe it or not, you can run TikTok and Snapchat and all that. It works. On my phone, I have Kindle. We pre-installed Waze on it. Waze is owned by Google, but it actually works. And I even have a Tesla app. I got Spotify, Netflix, all of that works fine. So there's really not, you're not giving up technology when you say do the Googling. What you lose is you can't watch YouTube on YouTube. You got to use the browser if you want to do that. You can do things on the browser. But as far as apps, you cannot install anything Google. You cannot install Gmail, anything Google Drive, none of that. Nothing Google will work. It will fail. Google Earth, you have to substitute for that. So anything Google has been substituted. Now, as far as what the actual danger is, again, the main issue is identity. Because the IMEI or the identifier that identifies your specific phone is not accessible because there's no Google app on there that can spot it, there's no way for a third-party app that is based on permissions, let's say TikTok, okay? And TikTok has been touted as being very dangerous. But TikTok cannot read the IMEI like Google can. It can't actually see anything. It doesn't even know the model of the phone precisely. So it can't find the phone number. It can't actually see any of that that Google can or Apple iPhone can. A third-party app of any sort, I don't care what it is, cannot do it on a Google phone. And permissions on location are pretty specific. If you block permissions for location, the app doesn't get location. Whereas Google, you say, I'm going to block location, and they can still get it. So a phone like this is pretty much hard to screw up, because how do you screw up? Well, let's say you're using Facebook. Well, Facebook has other tricks up their sleeve to go spot you. But let's pick TikTok again, because that's pretty known as a pretty bad, Chinese app, right? But what can even TikTok do? Because TikTok cannot even see all the other apps that are running on the phone. They don't know what else is on the phone. They just know themselves. They can't get location if you block it. They can't get the identity. They don't even know who you are. And if you create a fake identity on social media, and this applies to all social media, I don't understand how it can be a threat. So that's really important, is control your identity from your logins, two-factor authentication. And then a Google phone does not have that connection that allows cross-device tracking. So it's pretty much a perfect solution. Once you have a Google phone, you disappear from Google. You disappear.
That's fantastic. What about Apple? It sounds like if you have an Apple phone, you're pretty much out of luck, yes?
Yes, unfortunately, I do not have a solution for Apple. Apple, as you know, I don't know if you know, but I'll tell you, with your phone off, it turns into an AirTag. It's tracking your location 24/7, no matter what you do, as long as there's a trickle of a charge on that phone.
Now, what about VPNs while on the, surfing the internet? What's your take on VPNs?
Oh, that's really important. I have a trio of things that I consider to be key to privacy. And the number one is the Google phone. So having the right phone, not a normie phone, but a protected phone, like a Google phone of some sort. That's number one. Number two is a VPN. And because these are all used to identify you. And everything I talk about is really related to identity. So number two is VPN, because a VPN will prevent someone from identifying a specific IP address. The purpose of a VPN is to group you. So there's a bunch of you with the same VPNs, and they don't point to your home, your IP address, and they don't point to your home IP address. So therefore, there's no way to specifically identify you. So that's why it's very basic. Now, I will tell you this, though. If you're using a cell data, there is no IP address to worry about. So that's actually kind of like being in a VPN. If you're using Starlink, it's actually also like a VPN, because it doesn't have a fixed IP address since your unit is in the sky. So that's the IP address they see, is whatever, the satellite connects to. They don't see the IP address of your home router. So those are equivalent to VPN. The third protection item in my trio that to me is kind of basic, and it's part of the main protection scheme for privacy, is the, it's called browser isolation. So this is part of the identity problem that I talk about. Google has you identified by a Google ID. And if you log into Chrome with your Google ID, everything you do on the internet is not connected, as I said, to the phone and to everything you do on the internet. I don't care what website you go to, it's going to know what you do on that website. This is really, really frustrating because there's no way to stop this. So I found a way to stop this. I created this procedure, I think 7 years ago when I first realized this problem. And I've been talking about this and I came up with my own description of it and I call it browser isolation. So no one has ever used this term in the way I've used it. I've kind of invented it. And the scheme is this, it's very simple. You use multiple browsers and you leave Chrome as Google, but do not go to any other website that is not owned by Google on Chrome. So Chrome is for Google only. Now, what is the effect of this? Because the Google ID cannot cross browsers, the Google ID is then isolated to whatever you're doing on Google, which they already know, nothing happens. But if you go to Amazon, you do it on a different browser. So I have three or four browsers on every computer I use, and I set aside one for the other. So let's say you want to protect yourself, you go to some other platform that's not owned by Google, you keep it separate by having a different browser for it. That's called browser isolation. Now, what that happens is stops the Google ID identity, and everything I talk about is related to identity. It keeps that identity from crossing into whatever else you're doing on some other platform. And this trio of things is really pretty much essential to making sure that what you do on the internet is not tied to a specific identity. It's just random noise on the internet. And this is really the key to protecting it. That's it.
So give me an example, going back to the browsers. I use multiple browsers as well, but give me an example of something you're going to do on the internet where you're going to bounce from one browser to a different browser to a different browser.
Well, to me, it's really simple. If it's not Google, you can mm-hmm. use one browser for everything non-Google. I do that. So the one I use mostly, because I'm using Linux, is Chromium. Now, Chromium is actually the basis for Chrome. It's the basis for Edge. It's the basis for Brave. It's the basis for many other browsers. But when I go on Chrome, I can do anything. I can go to any website, but I never, never, never log into Google on that browser, never. Because once you log into Google in that browser, it keeps a cookie in there that identifies you, does browser fingerprinting. And then you're tracked, and everything you do on there will now be found by Google Analytics, and it will connect everything you do, because this is really the important part. Every website, pretty much 99% of all websites in the world, has Google Analytics.
Right.
What is Google Analytics? It's the code Google gives to you. Say, put this on your website so we can track your traffic and give you ads and whatever else they want and put you in our search engine. So everyone said, well, I want to be in the search engine, so I'm going to put Google Analytics. So just about every website has Google Analytics built in. Well, the Google Analytics detects your Google ID. And if you don't know this in the advertising world, you can actually spot people and say, oh, this person is interested in art photography and food and all that, because we know it from the Google ID. So if you do not have a Google ID, they cannot collect this information and put it into your record. So by leaving every other website to its own browser without a Google ID, then there's no way to collect that information, put it in any bucket. Now, on the Google side of things, you're using Chrome. So you're on YouTube. YouTube already knows what you're doing because you're in YouTube. You're in Google. Google already reads your Gmail, so it knows everything you're doing on Gmail. There's no secret there. That's a different problem that you need to investigate, but that is not part of the hardware setup I'm talking about here. I'm just giving you kind of the basis for the equipment you need
right.
to protect it, the tools. Now, there are procedures that you have to apply to all this if you want to be serious about this, but even what I said is enough. This will probably solve 80% of the problem. Just these
two. Right. So I have two quick questions on one, going back to the phone. What about the service provider? So let's say, okay, I'm going to buy the de-Googled phone And now I need to take it and I need to figure out, well, gee, do I want AT&T? Do I want Verizon? You know, what service am I going to get? And is the service provider itself going to be able to track anything or pass that information along, that type of thing?
Okay, it's a very good question. And this is why there has to be a separation of threats. So in my line of work, cybersecurity, you have to identify a threat model. That's a terminology I want to introduce here, a threat model. Who's the threat to you? You mentioned, some of you said your threat is, you know, advertisers and so on, which I don't think is really that much of a threat. The threat is actually the big player, big tech. Which big tech? I mean, carriers are big tech, and Google and Apple and Microsoft and Yahoo and so on are another big tech. So there are two kinds of segregated big tech that have a very serious impact on you. And both of them can do mass surveillance, those two groups of big tech, the carrier side and the normal social media platforms. The problem, though, is that the phone side of things, meaning the carriers, are tied to the government. So the specific threat of carriers relate to something called the CALEA law, C-A-L-E-A, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act. So everything you do on the phone network, it's called the PSTN, Public Switched Telephone Network. Everything you do on the phone network is surveilled and collected and recorded. It goes into the FBI, DCIS database, every call, every text, everything. Okay, so there's no real way of hiding that. That's just the way it is. So you have to think about when you want to be on the PSTN, since the phone network, since there's options now. You can use apps like Signal and Session and BraxMe, even my own app. You can use these to obfuscate your communication, so you don't have to be tracked with mass surveillance. So given that there's that option, then we have a solution. But the thing is that you cannot stop the phone companies from surveilling anything that you do, because it's part of the government system. It's actually linked in hardware. CALEA was passed during the Clinton administration, and they've actually integrated that by law into the hardware. So in every country, anyone can just tap you at will. There's not even the need for any physical wiretapping. They just go into software and just, you know, log in and tap you. And then they have a record of all your texts. It's in the FBI database. So
let me stop for a second. Isn't that a tremendous violation of our constitutional rights, for crying out loud? Or has that already been adjudicated? Forget about that.
That's a law. So they passed the law saying, we're going to do this.
What a joke.
It's pretty crazy, isn't it? But as you know, Snowden revealed the prison program, which is exactly this kind of tracking that I'm talking about. But now they actually made it easier. So Prism allows them to spy on all of your traffic. Now, there is a law that says they can't record your calls. So unless there's a warrant, they can't record your calls. But they have all the metadata. They know who you called, what time, how much time was spent, who the parties are, the phone numbers, and on and on and on. And they can capture the entire text. So texting is more dangerous than a phone call, because with a text, they actually see what you said. And there's no law that stops them from recording a text. So they record every text. So yeah, there's no protection here. It's just the way it is. And it's so the solution is to leave the phone network where you can. Don't use texting, don't use phones for normal use. You can use, for example, you can communicate with your friends using Signal. And by doing so, then you disappear from the phone network and they can't track you. And Do you
prefer Signal over Telegram?
I do not use Telegram. I do not prefer Signal. I prefer Session.
Session. I'm not familiar with Session.
Right. I made a new video on YouTube on Session, and it's way superior to, if you want privacy, because Signal requires a phone number. Session doesn't require anything. And Session is step above, because all the network traffic occurs in what is called the dark net. You cannot actually watch the traffic of Session, even if you tried to look at it from some three-letter agency level, because it's happening in the dark net, kind of like Tor. They have their own dark net that's not Tor.
I'm going to have to check that one out.
Right. So that's my new video, and that's my preferred way. You can use Signal for people you already know because they already know your phone number. But I will never talk to people. Like, if somebody doesn't know my phone number in advance, I'm not going to go talk to you in Signal because I have to give you my phone number.
Right.
But so on Session, I don't need a phone number. I just connect.
That's awesome. So now on two-factor, do you deem two-factor as a good thing or a bad thing? And should a person use an email as opposed to a phone number?
Oh, you don't have a choice. They don't give you a choice. So I'll tell you what you do. So there's no choice with 2FA. So do you need 2FA? Well, 2FA, as originally intended, is a good thing. And I made so many videos because I said it's a bad thing. And it's a bad thing because it was abused by certain parties. When your bank says, I need 2FA, you can say okay to the bank because that's your money. When somebody like Twitter says, I need 2FA, you start to wonder, well, why does Twitter need my 2FA? How important is that? Why does Facebook need my 2FA? Why does Google need my 2FA? And why are they so restrictive with it? The reason it's a problem is because Google, Facebook, those two specifically, have created this 2FA as a way to piggyback their surveillance. So I told you this before with cross-device tracking. So they're not just using 2FA for what it's intended for, which is two-factor authentication. They're saying, we're going to go beyond that. We're going to go beyond that. Because there are other ways to do two-factor authentication without giving a phone number. But we want to go beyond that. We want to track you. So Google and Facebook 2FA are extremely dangerous because they've gone beyond the normal 2FA reason. Because they're using it for cross-device tracking. They want to find out your specific device ID so they know what phone you're using and identify you by the phone. In fact, on Google, you can actually do two-factor authentication without a phone number as long as you assign a normal phone, like an iPhone, where they have the identity of the phone and they have the location at all times of that phone. And they say, okay, you don't have to use a phone number. You can use that.
And there's no way to opt out of this, right, Rob? There's no way to say, hey, listen, I don't want you surveilling me. This is, I've heard that you can turn off your location services, but that really doesn't even matter.
That's right.
They can still track you anyway. So is there any way that we can, that you can then legally opt out of this and say, I don't want to be surveilled? Or because you choose the terms and conditions when you log into your phone, it's all pretty much legally they're able to do that. Is that accurate?
That's correct. So there's no out with this. So my solution is that my phone here, the Brax 2 phone that I sell, has two SIMs. So my second SIM is a two-factor authentication SIM. Now, the important thing here is that the second phone number used for two-factor authentication must not be known to your friends. That's the important part. Because what they do to track you is they say, what is your phone number? And then they cross-check it against contact lists that people have uploaded, or sent on Gmail or uploaded to LinkedIn or whatever, Facebook. And then they can cross-check and find your real name. And this is a very common technique. So they can find you if you use the same phone number. They can say, I know who you are exactly, because we can search contact lists and find out what your phone number is. The solution that I said is use a second SIM card or a second phone, like a spare phone that you don't use much, that you leave off, and then use that for two-factor authentication. So in this case, I have a second SIM card. So if I need to do two-factor authentication and Google wants to do it because I have a YouTube account, then it goes to the second SIM card and the phone number is not known to anyone. In fact, I don't even know my own 2FA phone number because I keep changing it. And they cannot match it to anything. So that's what I use.
So the phone that you built there has two SIM cards in it?
That's right. Yeah. And like every phone that I will release will have two SIM card slots.
That's pretty brilliant, man. That's a pretty good thinking. I mean, you think you could put two SIM cards in a phone? That's pretty.
Practically no US phone has it. And iPhones, they actually are eliminating, they're going eSIM, which is a really bad idea for privacy. So two SIMs and this is the problem is you can say, well, that's kind of expensive to have two SIMs and two separate plans and on, right? Well, since the second number is going to be low volume use, it's really just going to be used for texting. I found a plan that can handle that, and I'm paying $60 a year. And that's what I'm using for two-factor authentication.
Wow, that's crazy cheap.
Very cheap.
So $60 a year, so basically $5 a month. And I have this security knowing that my phone number is not part of the Google tracking or Facebook tracking mechanism.
Now, are you doing it as a forward? Are you setting up numbers outside of it and doing it as a forward? No, it's a direct number that's just rolling over.
Right, because otherwise Google will not let you. It's got to be an actual phone. Now, you can change your phone number if you feel like, you know, you've been compromised in some way. So I guess it's just a SIM card. Just change the SIM card, go to your carrier and say, change my phone number. My old policy used to be that I used to change my phone number as often as once a month on that. I don't think that's necessary. I was a bit extreme. But since nobody knows the number, but if you feel like the number is now known because you accidentally gave it away to somebody, then you can change the phone number.
Right.
So, for occasional use.
So what were you going to say, James?
I was going to say, is there any advantages security wise, to be turn your Wi-Fi off at night, turn your phones off at night, that type of stuff, you know, or is that, I mean, are turning your computers off, or are they way beyond that, worrying about that now? I mean, they're
I don't know what that will do, because the moment you turn it on, then, you know, it queues up the, it's called caching. It caches all your location, everything you do. You turn the phone on and all the information gets sent then. So not sure that's actually doing anything. Now, some people do that, turn off Wi-Fi and all that, because they feel like they're getting frequency, whatever effects. Not my deal, so I don't worry about that. But the only one I would worry about is an iPhone. So my iPhone, since I don't use it except for 2FA, is kept in a Faraday bag, and it is on there 99.9% of the time, unless I need an emergency 2FA. It's only for emergency 2FA. I don't use it.
Okay, let me ask you about search engines. So what is your preference or recommendation? You know, I hear people go back and forth, like as far as Firefox or Brave, or, you know, what search engines do you recommend, or do you think it's not even relevant to how they're gathering information?
Oh, it's very relevant, because the Google ID is connected also. If you do browser isolation, it kind of cuts some of that, but if you don't do browser isolation, and obviously everything you do on the searching on Google is part of that record. So even on the Chrome, in the browser isolation thing I mentioned, even on that Chrome browser where I'm on Google Chrome, I do not use Google search on that. I make sure that Google's turned off. And my preferred one is startpage.com. The advantage of StartPage actually uses Google search, but it takes off your identity. This is that back to that identity problem. And so that's my preferred one to use. Now, some people use DuckDuckGo for a long time and Brave recently. And you can use Brave. I have no problem with Brave. The search results on startpage.com are better, so I would prefer that for that reason. But DuckDuckGo started to get political, and so did Firefox. So they started to do censorship.
That's right.
And that really bothered me. So for that reason, I would not use DuckDuckGo, since last year they started to censor. So if I'm going to get censored results, just like Google manipulates my results, then bye-bye.
What about Opera? Opera has a built-in...
Oh, gosh.
Opera has a built-in... firewall, apparently. Opera, you're not a fan of that?
Oh gosh, Opera is Chinese.
Okay,
it's owned by the Chinese, and it's not really a VPN. What they offer in Opera is called a proxy, which means they can spy on you on the proxy. So everything you do on Opera will go to the proxy. They can go see what you're doing, what website you're visiting, and use that information. And so why would you use Opera? So no, If all, I only have one browser that I tell people never, never, ever to use, and that's Opera.
So now what about storage? As far as a lot of people use, well, of course, Google Drive, but a lot of people are hooked into the clouds, you know, whether it's through their phone or their computers, and they're using it for storage. Is there anything you recommend outside of that that people should use instead?
Yeah, yes. In fact, I'm making a video on it probably in the next month.
Perfect.
So I don't have the answer that I want to give you right now because I have to test it. But there's a hardware solution where you can reach your home cloud, your computer, your server in the cloud can be reached, which is at your home, and using your phone, you can do that. So that's what I'm suggesting. It's a hardware solution, but I have to test it out before I start saying, oh, this is what's going to be a good solution. So it's not a sponsored video. It's something I will actually test out. And then once I've said, okay, this seems to work, then I will have that offered solution. The alternative solution for somebody more techie is to install your own cloud in the cloud, which is obviously more expensive solution since you have to have a cloud account. And that is to use Nextcloud. That's the, if you are techie, you can set up your own Nextcloud server.
What about ProtonMail? ProtonMail is sort of a secure offshore, apparently, server where you send your mail out there. It's not really processed in the United States. Apparently, it's supposed to be secure. Any thoughts on ProtonMail?
Definitely. I have a very hated video by ProtonMail on that because I said, don't use ProtonMail. So, if you understand how email works, and email is a big topic for me. I make many videos. I'm very experienced with email. I made my own email servers and email clients back in the day, you know, since the 90s. So I'm very skilled with this and I understand exactly how to do this. I actually made a product kind of like ProtonMail, which actually caused me to understand that I shouldn't be doing this. And let me, okay. Funny. And this is why I stopped doing it, because I actually offered it and I watched the traffic and I said, oh my gosh, we can't do this. Now, what happens is if you're using ProtonMail, just understand that 99.9% of your mail is not encrypted. Why? Because you're talking to Gmail, Yahoo.
Right.
Okay. You're talking to other people. You're not talking to ProtonMail people. The encryption, as it was even with my own product, is only intra-domain. So in my case, was Braxmail to Braxmail. Yeah, that's encrypted. But as you leave that, then it's not encrypted. So what is the point of your going to ProtonMail then if ProtonMail can read everything that goes through? What are you actually gaining? Well, what you gain, I'm going to tell you, is a negative gain. It's actually a loss, is that you've announced to people that you're using ProtonMail.com or Tutanota, which is equivalent, and other ones, that you have something to hide. Now, why in the heck would you need to do that when your mail is open anyway? Since there is no way to encrypt normal mail, which is 99.9% of what you do, I don't need that solution. I just need to make sure that my email provider is not using my data for analysis like Google is. So I offer Braxmail, that's my product, and people use that. Or you can use any paid email service that doesn't, you know, I don't really care who it is, as long as it's not part of the Google, Microsoft, yeah, you know, one of those big tech companies that actually collect your data. Now, in my case, the difference is in the Braxmail that I made, and this is important to me because of the IP address problem. When you send out email, your IP address is on the email. And I don't know if you know that, but, you know, every email you send out identifies you. Solution, have a product that removes identifiers from the email, which Braxmail does. That's the only thing I need to do because the email itself is already clearly spied on. I already mentioned that since the 90s, right? I said the beginning of this.
What about like pretty good protection, like PGP, where you used to encrypt it on one end, you send the encryption key.
Yeah.
You know how that is? Is that still a solid way to encrypt messages via email that you want to keep secure?
Yes, but it only encrypts the body. It doesn't encrypt the header, the title, the metadata that says you communicate with X. So let's say you're a whistleblower, which back in the day, there's Snowden times, he didn't really have an option. Well, maybe he had an option, but not that something that most people use. How does he send out a whistleblower message to somebody without metadata? Because he had metadata. All he encrypted was the body. So it could be clear that somebody that was attributed to his, he probably hid his IP address, but somebody attributed to him was contacting, you know, Greenwald over at Intercept or whatever. And so that's an issue. So GPG, it's called GPG now. GPG encryption is obviously useful when you want to obscure the body. So financial information, for example, you can use that. But it doesn't obscure who you're talking to. The metadata exists, and so that's not a good idea. So obviously the solution is to not use email.
That was actually my next question, was about metadata. So in documents or even in photos, you know, if someone's uploading a photo to social media or they're sharing documents or PDFs, what do you recommend for, you know, ways of stripping the metadata out of images or documents? Or, you know, you just covered emails, but.
Well, so in, let's say you're using a de-Googled phone where you know you can actually block real location, then all you have to do is just not give location permission to the photo app. And so it will not have location on there. So that's the easiest way. And then there are many, many apps out there can actually, in fact, Braxme does it. You upload a photo to Braxme and you download it, it strips off the metadata. But you don't normally have to do that if you stop the permissions for location for ever going your photo. So always, it doesn't matter what the phone is, even if you're using an iPhone or a Google Android, always never give location permissions to the photo and gallery apps. And that will stop that piece of metadata. Now, there's no actual piece of metadata that's in a PDF file. The metadata is part of the format for a photo, but the PDF has the original metadata when you created the PDF, like who made it and all that. And that's going to stay with it, just like with any Microsoft Office document. It has all that, like the timestamp, what's created and all that. The only way to remove that is to take the data and cut and paste it into a new document.
Can I ask you, I have one final question for you, Rob. I know we're probably coming to the end here pretty close. What about a burner phone? Is that, you know, like you've heard of the burner phones where you buy the phones at Walmart or something for $40 and you pay $30 for a month's subscription. Is that still, do they still track you with that? Is that something that's, at least a quick fix if you're out on the road or something and you want to, you know, like you said, like a whistleblower and you want to meet with somebody privately or something. Is that, how's that as far as privacy is concerned?
You know, it's funny, the questions you have is almost like all the videos in my channel. So I actually had a video demonstrating this. It was called the Jason Bourne video. And
that's funny.
I love that series, by the way. The idea of the video was you're trying to escape the government. What do? You're escaping, and every mistake you could possibly make so that you can be spotted. At the end of the video, you're spotted anyway, but you can delay it for a while if you know all the techniques. So it's not perfect. So Jason Bourne cannot escape, so he has to fight his way out at the end. But anyway, the trick is, and this takes some pretty advanced thinking to understand this, but the moment you use a phone, let's say your burner phone, this is a thing that most people do not understand. They don't track you with a burner phone. They can't track you with a burner phone. They don't know who you are, right? At least not initially. They can find out later on because they know where you bought the phone. But they can't track you when you use the burner phone, but they can track who you ducking. They can track who you call. So if you call your wife, well, if somebody's listening to you, they're not going to track you. They don't know who you are, but they know you call your wife every day at a certain time, and they're going to say, "Ah, gotcha." Okay, so the only way to use a burner phone where they don't, you know, they don't track you, is to use it only once, and then throw it away. This is, you watch all the spy movies, so they've at least learned that. And the only secure way to use a burner phone in a secure way that's it's slightly safer is to use two burner phones on for both parties, one on each side, and use it only once. Beyond that, it's not very useful. So the actual answer is don't use burner phones, use Signal, use something else, use Session. Burner phones are kind of out of date kind of solution. They're for drug runners.
There you go. So what would you recommend for a computer system? Are we talking Linux or?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. You know, if you want to remove, did you know that the Mac OS? So they put many of my videos I've talked about the fact that Apple started putting this AI tracking your content pre-encryption. So they're doing that to look at your pictures or whatever's on your device using the AI given instructions to spot the content before you encrypt it and send it over the air. So that's the new thing that they're doing now. And in fact, it's they're passing a law in the UK to require that kind of behavior. And their excuse is that this is going to be used for CSAM or, you know, illegal photos, you know, of minors. So they're using that as an excuse. We're going to spot every traffic on any device. And Apple's implemented that first. So,
wow. How long ago did they start implementing that? Do you know?
Apple already has the technology to do it now. They claim they haven't started it, but they have the technology to do it now. The UK hasn't passed a law yet, but they're trying to do that. And Signal just released a press release saying, there's no way we're going to allow that on Signal, even though whatever law is required and would just leave the country. So if they can enforce people actually leaving Signal, because they can't really do that. You can download the Signal app without using any app stores. You can't actually block Signal from anything.
Rob, why don't you give us, I'm sorry. I apologize. I thought you were finished at that point. Go ahead.
I kind of forgot the question that Corey was asking.
I was asking about the computer system.
Oh, yeah.
Linux.
Oh, yeah. So the only device that we know for sure that doesn't have any of that is, of course, Linux. And I use Linux myself. Windows can be set up to remove the spyware. So it's not, you can probably remove 99% of the spyware. And I have a setup video for it. So you can do that, but you can't do it to a Mac OS. So if you're going to use a Mac, then you're pretty much done. they gotcha.
Gotcha. I just have one last quick question, James, and then I know we got to wrap this up. So I think open source software is really important. And I actually ditched Microsoft Office a couple years ago because of several reasons, aside from having to pay them. To, you know, scrape all my data, and went to open source LibreOffice. And so I just wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, as just kind of another way to save money and hopefully prevent even more of your data from being scraped, going with open source versus some of these, you know, software programs that where they all want you on these subscriptions now.
Right. I use LibreOffice, so.
Yeah.
So that confirms that I do not use anything Microsoft Office, and I'm using Linux, so that already limits me to using mostly free solutions for things. So, you know, when you use Linux, you will tend to be using free software and open source software.
Got it.
It's the nature of the beast.
Rob, great interview, great information. Where can people find out more about you and find out more about your phones and everything you've got going on with the mail server and all that stuff?
Right. So if you're on YouTube, I'm Rob Braxman Tech on YouTube and I have a big channel there. And I'm also easily found on rumble.com, Rob Braxman Tech over there. And I'm also on odyssey.com. Rob Braxman Tech over there. I'm also on Twitter, Rob Braxman Tech on Twitter. But YouTube is the one where I have the most subscribers.
Fantastic. So
follow me there.
Corey, anything that you want to say in closing?
And your website?
My website is Braxme. So I made my own social media platform for the privacy interested people. So I have like close to 100,000 people on there. So they can go to brax.me, and there's an app for that as well. Or you can just go visit the website, and that's where you find the community and the store of my products and talk to the people in the community.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this. I think this will be a big help for people.
Great. Yeah. Brax.me, Brax.me. And folks, we're just come to the end of another podcast here on the Solution Series. We do much, so much appreciate you looking in here and supporting the broadcast. You can find out more about the Solution Series by going to Corey'sDigs.com or Solari.com. And for us, the Solution Series, this is James White saying bye now. Thank you.